For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We are going to continue in this series of Genesis, and we're in Genesis 22. Very tough passage. Let me show you how tough this is. This is a very hard passage. It's the concept of who do you think God is? Genesis 22, known as the binding of Isaac. Sometime later, in the earlier chapter, Abraham had made a covenant with this guy named Abimelech that they would be nice to each other. And so this kicks off from there and says, sometime later, God tested Abraham's faith. Abraham, God called. Yes, he replied, here I am. Please take your son. This may not say please in your translation, but there's a particle that precedes the word take that is always translated please. And God only uses this when he's asking you to do something very hard. So it could read, I beg you, take your son, or please take your son, your only son. Yes, Isaac, whom you love so much, and go to the land of Moriah. Go and sacrifice him as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, which I'll show you. It's hard to go on, really. And yet he did. He didn't say no. He didn't walk away. I don't know if he argued with God. He had a habit of arguing with God. I'm assuming there's some arguing. But we don't read about that. All we read is the next morning, Abraham got up early. He saddled his donkey, took two of his servants with him, along with his son Isaac. Then he chopped wood for a fire for a burnt offering and set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day of their journey, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. Stay here with the donkey. Abraham told the servants, the boy and I will travel a little farther. By boy, you may get the impression this is a kid, but this term, translated boy, is used, for instance, in Chronicles to refer to young men of military age. The fact that he carried all this firewood up the mountain suggests that he wasn't a kid. He was a late teens, early 20s. Guy. So the boy and I will travel farther, we'll worship there, and then we'll come right back. So Abraham placed the wood for the burnt offering on Isaac's shoulders while he himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them walked together, Isaac turned to Abraham and said, Father? Yes, my son. Abraham replied, we have the fire and the wood, the boy said, but where's the sheep for the burnt offering? God will provide a sheep for the burnt offering, my son. Abraham answered, and they both walked on together. When they arrived at the place where God had told him to go, Abraham built an altar. This is the Hebrew word for this is only and always used for human sacrifice. The other word for altar for animal sacrifice, a totally different word. And arranged the wood on it. Then he tied his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. At this point, we have no narrative, we don't know, but at this point, Isaac must have been told what God had asked Abraham to do, and he must have been complicit in it. Abraham's 100 years old. You know, he's like, between 17 and 24. I guarantee you, my kid, who's 17, could keep totally away from me at 56. And he could certainly resist me. It must have been that Isaac, at some point in their conversation, must have agreed to let his father tie him up. And Abraham picked up the knife to kill his son as a sacrifice. At that moment, the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. Yes, Abraham replied, here I am. Don't lay a hand on the boy, the angel said. Don't hurt him in any way, for now I know that you truly fear God. You have not withheld from me even your son, your only son. Well, let's pray and go home. You can meditate on this throughout the rest of the day. Abraham looked up and he saw a ram caught by its horns in a thicket. Rams are offered to dedicate priests, and rams are offered to atone for sin. He took the ram and he sacrificed it as a burnt offering in the place of his son. Abraham named the place Yahweh Yireh, which means the Lord will provide to this day. People still use that name as a proverb. On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided. Well, you know, maybe you're so familiar with the story that you know the ending and you're like, oh, it's no big deal. It all worked out. But I have a 17-year-old kid, and I'm trying to imagine walking up the mountain with him, carrying the wood and standing there and putting the rocks around and arranging the wood on it. And he's like, Evan, God told me to offer you as a whole burnt offering. Really? Why would God ask such a thing? This is horrifying. This is the kind of stuff you read in the newspaper about psychotic people do. Well, the simplest answer is in verse 1. God asked for this to test Abraham's faith. And faith might not mean much to you, but it means a lot to God. But let's talk about what this means. What does it mean to test his faith? The term test comes from this Hebrew word nesa, which means to refine. It's the same word that's used of purifying gold or purifying silver, to bring it under heat so the impurities separate. And it also means to reveal. You know, the silver is ready to be cast when it's heated up and it's refined, and the silversmith can see his reflection in it, then it's ready to cast. And so it refines and reveals something. What does it reveal? It says it reveals his faith. It refines and reveals Abraham's faith. Okay, that's a throwaway word for Christians and spiritual people. But what exactly does this mean? Faith means to believe. And in this case, what he's refining is what Abraham believes about him. Not about Abraham, but about God. And what he's revealing is what Abraham actually believes about God. And you may be feeling like, dude, you know, really? Is God such an insecure guy that he's going to ask him to do this thing so that he can refine and reveal that Abraham's like, God, you're number one with me? But faith means a lot to God. In Peter's letter, in his first letter, he talks about these people going through terrible hardship. And it says, this hardship you're going through is like gold being refined, and your faith is being refined in a similar way, and your faith is more precious than gold. Gold will perish. Your faith won't. You know, I'm giving you sort of my version of that passage, but that's essentially it. That your faith is very precious to God. Well, why is my feeling toward God, my confidence in God, why is it so important to him? I guess it's important to him in the same way that if I had an infant that was failing to thrive because it wouldn't eat, that why this infant eating milk would be so important to me. That if he doesn't eat the milk, he'll die. If the infant could relate to me rationally, he might say, what is the deal? Why is it so important? Why are you so upset that I'm not eating milk? Because I want you to live. From God's perspective, faith is that important. It has eternal ramifications. What you think about him has eternal ramifications. So it may not feel like a big deal to you, but I would suggest maybe there's something you don't get. Because God thinks what you think about him matters more than anything. Well, okay, let's go on. So what God was doing was refining what Abraham believed about God, and he was showing Abraham and others what Abraham believed about God. Now, this isn't the first time he's been through this process. God said, leave your land, go to the land that I'm going to show you. And how was Abraham's faith revealed? He got up and he left. And then there was a drought, so he's in the land God promised, and God's like, this is all yours. Now you can't live here. Go to Egypt. And he goes to Egypt, and his wife is just drop-dead gorgeous. And he forgets, really, that God said, I'm going to make a great nation out of you. He only thinks people are going to see you, Sarah, and they're going to be like, oh, baby, kill Abraham. And so he lies. He says, hey, just between you and me, just say you're my sister. Because it's kind of true. And so he went through that experience, and what did that hardship reveal? It revealed he believed God enough to go to the right place, but he didn't believe God enough to take care of him. I mean, how's God going to make a great nation out of him if he's dead? There's an implication to this promise, and that is that he'll survive. But he didn't pass that test. But there are other times he did. He sometimes passed it, he sometimes didn't. And then finally, this Isaac was born. So if a voice came to me in the middle of the night and said, Lee, take your son, Evan, whom you love, and offer him as a whole burnt offering, I could go to many, many Bible passages and say, this voice is not God's voice, because it says here, he despises this. It says over here, this never even enters his mind. It says over here, you know, there's just so many Bible passages that make it clear that human sacrifice is not cool. It's abominable. God's judgment comes on people because they were doing things like this in the land of Abraham at the time he was there. It wouldn't have been unusual for Abraham to have heard this request because other people were sacrificing their kids. Quid pro quo. I give you something valuable so I can get something back from you, whoever the God was. I'll kill my child so that I can have barley. This was not abnormal in the world he lived in. But let me ask you a question. What Bible did Abraham have to work with? There was no Bible. The first five books of the Bible weren't even written until centuries after this. What did he have to work with? What did he know? You can't have belief if you don't know anything. What did he know? Well, he knew a few things. He knew God gave unearned gifts. Hey, Abraham, leave the land of your father and go to the land I'm going to show you. That land will be yours. I'm going to make a great nation out of you. You'll have many, many descendants. You'll be a great nation. Anyone who blesses you, I'll bless. Anyone who curses you, I'll curse. And through your people, every people of the world will be blessed. It's vague enough, you don't know how. We're going to have to look at this. How is it God going to bless everyone through the Jewish people? But that's the promise. And did Abraham go, it's about time. You know, I've been busting hump here to get this wage from you, God. No, it was completely unearned. So he at least knew God gave gifts that were unearned. What else did he know? He knew God was a fierce judge of sin. The city of Sodom and the city of Gomorrah were full of social injustice. It was just gross injustice in this land, and it was so much so that God destroyed them. And at the end of that account of Sodom and Gomorrah, it says Abraham saw the smoke. He knew in advance God was going to do it. He argued with God about it, but in the end, God did judge, and Abraham saw, okay, this is one of those whoa effects you have when you realize I'm not dealing with a senile grandpa. I'm dealing with someone who is white hot angry over sin, and he will do something about it. What else did he know? He knew he kept his promises. You know, he promised Abraham that he would be a nation would come from him. And initially, he didn't know it was going to be through Sarah, but later God clarified, no, it's going to be through Sarah. You and Sarah are going to have a child. This child's going to be the father of these nations. And so if he had just been sexually active with his wife when she was young and fertile and she'd had a kid, who knew? Who would know? Yes, it's just natural. Oh, yeah, God promised a great nation would come from you. And his neighbor's like, and me too, me too, me too, me too. But no, he waited. He waited until Sarah's life went on and it turns out she's infertile. He waited until after she went through menopause, and he waited really, really long after her menopause until she was as good as dead. And then he gave a child. When God passed through Abraham's camp on his way to Sodom and Gomorrah, he said, next year around this time, you're going to have a child. And Sarah was like listening at the tent flap. And she went, and God turned to her and said, why did you laugh? She said, I didn't laugh. You did laugh. A year later, she has a kid and she calls him laughter. That's what Isaac means. God keeps his promises. Now, did Abraham always deserve this promise? I mean, there's a promise, but Abraham didn't always behave himself. You know, he did this thing with Egypt, but he did the same thing later with Abimelech. He went there and he's like, you know, as old as you are, lady, you're still gorgeous, and someone's going to kill me to get you. And he lied again. He knew God kept his promises even when it was impossible, and he knew God kept his promises even when he didn't deserve it. He knew this much. And there's one thing he knew for absolutely sure. He knew God promised Isaac would be his heir. This pops up in several places, not just one, Genesis 17 and Genesis 21. He says, it's through Isaac. It's through Isaac. It's through it. God made it very clear. And Abraham knew this. He had 3 days from the time God said, offer your son, until he was on the rocks with his son. And he had a lot of time to think about what he knew. What did he think was going to happen? He didn't probably know exactly what was going to happen. The author of Hebrews said he figured God was going to raise Isaac from the dead. But he did know Isaac would survive whatever was about to happen. Because God keeps his promises, even when they're impossible. You can see this in verse 5 when he says, the boy and I will travel a little farther, we'll come worship there, and then we will come right back. We see it later when Isaac's saying, so where's the sheep, Dad? And he says, God will provide a sheep for the burnt offering, my son. So we see in his responses that he expects God to keep his word. And in the end of it all, he says, I know that you truly fear God because you've not withheld from me even your son, your only son. And this is just about as irritating as sacrifice your son. Fear God, like in Bruce Almighty. Smite me, thou great smiter. Fear God, be very afraid. I feel like we need to take a break here, just a moment, and take a hard look at this issue of what it means to fear God. And I'm not going to soft pedal it for you. Part of it includes fear. But let's take a look. We have more Bible than Abraham had. We have more references than Abraham had. But let me just give you my summary of what I think the fear of the Lord is, and then we'll look at it in some verses. It means humility before God. And it means loyalty to God. Humility is not to think less of yourself, it's to think less about yourself. It means that you realize I'm dealing with someone that's super awesome, and I need to arrange myself underneath them. Loyalty means that even if it looks scary because you have certain confidence in God, you're going to go ahead and be loyal, even though you can't figure it out. You can't work it out. And so let me just give a few things that are supposed to, according to the Bible, are supposed to cause us to fear the Lord. One thing is that he's created everything. The fact that he's the creator is supposed to create in us a sense of fear. This sense of humility and loyalty. So here, check this out. In Psalm 33, 8 through 9, it says, let the whole world fear the Lord and let everyone stand in awe of him. For when he spoke, the world began. It appeared at his command. Check that out. Isn't that cool? Those are diatoms. They're algae wearing armor. And there's a lot of kind of algae. There's algae without armor. You know of these things. If you have a swimming pool, one of your filters is filled with diatomaceous earth, these little skeletons. Right? These things are awesome because they make oxygen. You like breathing? You can thank these guys and other plants as well. If these things were to die, it would take very little time before we would all die. Check this out. Does it look like macrame? Really interesting. Maybe building a ship out of string. I don't know. This is a mosquito heart. Isn't that beautiful? Let's put away our microscope and take out our telescope. This is where we live. See? Right there it says sun. We are one star and 400 to 800 billion stars. It was 200 to 400 billion a few weeks ago, and they realized there's a whole bunch of stars that are very, very dim, and it doubled. Now, this isn't a picture. This is an artist's rendition. There's a black hole in the middle. We're not so close that we get burned up with radiation. We're not so far out that we'll freeze. We're exactly where we are. Let's take our telescope and focus at the darkest patch of sky we can find and then magnify. Look at that. More stars. Wait a minute. Those aren't stars. They're more galaxies. There are 400 to 800 billion of these. Do you think the being that made all of this is your personal assistant? When this grips you, you have begun to be humbled before who God is. You're beginning to experience the fear of the Lord. I don't mean by my comment, my crack here, that God isn't interested in you personally. He's very interested in you personally. This is part of what's so awesome about him. I'm saying your agenda is frequently the only thing on your mind, and you're trying to figure out, when you think about God at all, how he can get behind your agenda. But when you realize that he made everything, as the psalm calls out, you should feel humbled by this and awed by it. It should produce a sense of loyalty to him. That's not all. He's unique and he's perfect. When Isaiah has a vision of God, he has a vision of standing before God, and there's these creatures that are flying around and they're yelling, "Holy, holy, holy." Now, you may wonder why in the Bible you hear things like truly, truly, holy, holy, holy. Why do you hear this? Because in Hebrew, in order to emphasize something or to clarify something, they repeat the word. If I wanted to say gold, I would use the Hebrew word for gold. If I wanted to say pure gold, the Hebrews would use the same word twice, gold, gold. If I wanted to say the very purest gold, they would go gold, gold, gold. So when the angels are saying holy, 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 don't yawn and go, "One holy is enough, thank you." They're trying to say there is no one in the universe more distinct, more unique, more righteous than you. And Isaiah was so overwhelmed by the vision of the presence of God, he said, "I'm a dead man because the things that come out of my mouth are corrupt. And I live with people who are just like me." By seeing God, by seeing how unique and perfect he was, he recognized how desperate his need was. He protects and he delivers. Psalm 34, "I prayed to the Lord and he answered me. He freed me from all my fears, for the angel of the Lord is a guard. He surrounds and defends all who fear him." The fear that drives out all other fears. He rules. In Psalm 2, the psalmist writes to the kings of the world who think they are all that and they don't have to answer to anyone. He said, "Remember that God is a ruler and tremble." He judges. Now, this is where I feel like a lot of times people say the fear of the Lord just means awe. Like, "Oh, wow, oh, wow, 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 you are so awesome." But sometimes it means stark raving terror. I just got to be honest with you. Jesus himself, little gentle Jesus, said, "Don't be afraid of the one who can kill your body. Be afraid of the one who can destroy both body and soul in hell." I think I'm pretty good. You don't get to say. I think I'm better than most. It's not your call. That's arrogant. That's prideful. God says you have a moral need, and you either accept his solution or you pay yourself. Paul himself says, "Knowing the terror of the Lord, we persuade about this gift of forgiveness through Christ." For those of us who have, you know, I'm like 17 when this happened. For those who've done this, they pass out from underneath this kind of fear. There's no fear now because we passed out from judgment because Christ took it in our place. But if you haven't done that and you're not fearful, you're foolish. Because when it's all said and done, you don't get to say. You stand before the one who does. And he says, "You have a need, and I'll provide for that need, but you need to recognize you need it and ask for it." Well, fear of the Lord then, I mean, of course, that is humility and loyalty, too, to move toward God. And also that he forgives. Now, this is interesting. In Psalm 134, he says, "With you, God, there is forgiveness. Therefore, you are feared." Imagine if you're married being unfaithful to your spouse. Like grossly unfaithful to your spouse. And imagine that your spouse offers you forgiveness. Would you not be humbled? Would you not be loyal? Maybe not. Maybe you wouldn't be. Maybe you're a serial polygamist or something. But, you know, for most people to be forgiven is to be filled with this kind of fear, this humility and this loyalty. With you there's forgiveness, therefore you're feared. Well, I guess I would ask, you know, God didn't ask you to sacrifice your son, your only son whom you love, but how do you test? How do you reveal what you believe about him? How do you find out, as you reflect on your own heart, whether you're humble, whether you're loyal? I got a few questions that might test that. Question of who do you think God is? Do you tend to be grateful? I was driving my daughter to an event this last week, and she was full of complaints all day long. You know, I don't have enough pants. My pants are dirty and they need to be washed. And now I'm wearing pants that didn't get thoroughly dried and my skin is itchy. And my mom didn't do this for me like she said she was. And my brother did that to me like he shouldn't do. And she just went on and on and on. I'm sitting there driving thinking, I'm glad we're going to a far off place. And I'm not sure, I'm absolutely sure that lecturing her is a bad plan. And so I thought, okay, do you enjoy your friend, Katya? You were hanging out with her yesterday? Yeah, did you have fun? Yeah. Did you enjoy hanging out with Emily today? Yeah. Did you do things that were fun for you? Mm-hmm. Did you like your Christmas gifts? Yeah. And I just started going through everything I could think of that she should be grateful for, and I didn't do it. I didn't end it with, and therefore you should be grateful. I just thought she needs to have her mind turned to things that are good. And in the end, we pulled up in the driveway, she kissed me, and off she went. What changed? Her pants were still itchy. She changed. She was beginning to be grateful, where before she'd been full of self-pity. I've spent most of my life feeling sorry for myself, but I've come to realize over the last few years that this self-pity that I'm so full of and I move towards so easily is me saying, I deserve better. Some people are very demanding. Give me this, give me that. Come on, give me this. I'm not like that. I'm much more, I didn't get this, I didn't get that. Feel sorry for me. What do you think I believe about God? Probably nothing at all. But if I did pause to think about God at all, I would be thinking, he doesn't give me what I deserve. And some of you clever people would say, thank God for that. This is a litmus test of who you think God is. Gratitude. What about this? How interested are you in getting God, that is understanding him and what he wants? Do you view the life circumstances that you're in through the lens of what is God up to here? Do you get into this book, which is God revealing himself in order to understand him better? And frankly, in order to understand what you should give him better. This isn't a precious moments collection for you to stick up on your fridge. Oh, he cares about me. Oh, look. He always thinks about me. I think all these things are true about God, but if you look at the universe, at the Creator, you have to realize at some point, okay, I'm very small. And my agenda really tucks under very nicely God's big agenda, and I want to know what that is so that I can advance His purposes. I think, you know, if you're in the habit of reading little short passages of Scripture prayerfully, once a day, 20 minutes, 30 minutes at tops, reflecting on it and asking yourself, what if I actually thought this was true? Asking yourself, why would God be showing me this now? Just meditation, chewing on it, thinking about it, praying about it. I think it would prepare you to have confidence in God, to be humble and to be loyal. When your faith is tested, that is your precious, I'm not trying to be Gollum here. You know, the dot, dot, dot means what's precious to you. When the thing that's precious to you is threatened, how do you react? Maybe this is another way to look at it. What makes you anxious? What really makes you mad? What, if you lost it, would make you wish you were dead? So, for instance, a lot of people during this holiday season have experienced anxiety or anger because they were blocked from experiencing pleasure. Some of you experienced anger or anxiety because you were disapproved of by that rotten family, that extended one, you know, or your own kids. Some of you were anxious and angry because you weren't working. And you only feel like you're really alive when you're accomplishing. Some of you are anxious and angry because you didn't have control. And you only feel comfortable when you have control. These are your precious. These are your Isaacs. These are the things that are your God substitutes. They may be good things, but they become God things and are bad things. These are all tests, litmus tests of what we really believe. When a good thing becomes a God thing, it's a bad thing. All right, so back to this issue of Abraham. You know, I said, what was the reason why Abraham was asked to do this? And I said, the simple answer is God was testing his faith. But there's actually a more complicated answer than this, or a more complete answer. What I said was true, but there's more that maybe it's hard, a little harder to tease out of this passage. And I'm just going to flat out say it. I think the person who was speaking to Abraham was Jesus. He said, wait a minute, it says the angel of the Lord. Actually, it says the messenger Yahweh. And anytime you see that expression, the messenger Yahweh, notice what's going on. And it comes up several times. Notice what's going on, that this messenger Yahweh receives worship, which no angel ever does. This messenger Yahweh speaks as if he's God, which no angel ever does. Jesus existed before he was embodied. And this may well be an example of us seeing him. I'm 98% sure this was him. For a couple of other reasons. For another reason is that, remember in the beginning it said, Abraham was told by God, go to the place I'm going to show you. He saw the place far off. He went to the place. What was the place? It was Moriah. What's Moriah? This is the place where the temple would sit. This is the place where Jesus would be crucified. This is the place that Abraham was sent with his son. And Jesus himself referred back to this incident. In John 8, when Jesus was having a dialogue with the Jews, they accused him of being demon-possessed, and Jesus said, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and was glad. Now, I carefully went through every reference I could find in the narrative of Abraham to find any other situation where this would more apply than the one we're in, and I don't see it. Abraham, when he heard God say, stop, and he saw the ram in the thicket, rejoiced. Why? Because there was a substitute for his son, someone who was going to take his place. Well, the people that Jesus was talking to, these religious leaders, thought this is more evidence of his insanity. The Jews therefore said to Jesus, you're not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? And Jesus said to them, truly, truly, now that you understand how Hebrew emphasizes things, you know he's saying, I'm telling you the absolute truth. Before Abraham was born, I am. Not I was. It's not grammatically correct, but it is this name, Yahweh. It's the personal name of God. I am. And they picked up stones to throw at him because they understood totally what he was saying. He was saying, I am God. I was the one that was there. I was the one that stopped Abraham's hand. I was the one that provided the substitute. I am the substitute. Let's finish the story of Abraham and Isaac. Then the angel of the Lord, who I like to call Jesus, called again to Abraham from heaven. This is what the Lord says, because you've obeyed me and have not withheld even your son, your only son. You see this language, your son, your only son, the very same language used in the New Testament of Jesus. I swear by my own name that I will certainly bless you. I will multiply your descendants beyond number, like the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will conquer the cities of their enemies. And through your descendants, all of the nations of earth will be blessed, all because you've obeyed me. This is the first time, and it's frankly much easier to see from the perspective of the New Testament than it is to see at the time. This is the first time we begin to see the form of this blessing that God keeps promising. The form of the blessing is God will provide a substitute. God will intercede. God will solve the problem that you've created. Couple of quick points and we'll wrap it up. Who do you think God is? I guess I would just ask, are you humbled by the little bit you know about God and drawn toward him in light of what you know enough to let Jesus substitute for you? Dude, I pay my own way. This is not a way you want to pay for. There's a ram that's head is caught in thorns that paid the price for you. Will you receive it? When Jesus was dying on the cross, he was dying as your substitute and mine. He was dying the death that I deserved. He was dying the death that you deserved. He was going through hell so you wouldn't have to go through hell. Are you going to let the knife fall to your throat, or are you going to say, I'm totally cool with Christ substituting for me? I think this is serious and you need to consider it if you haven't. But for those that have done this, I would just say, are you humbled by and drawn toward God enough to put your agenda underneath his? This hunger you have to never be thought ill of, are you willing to tuck that under God's agenda? Are you willing to say, you know, the fact that you value me, God, is going to have to be enough for me? I'm tucking that underneath your agenda, that hunger for approval. Are you going to take the fact that God says you do matter and he's given you things to do that do matter, are you willing to take that and tuck that under his agenda? Are you going to work from him saying you're significant? Or are you going to keep working for a significance of your own making? Are you going to keep trying to control everything and keep everything in place? Or are you going to say, God, this is totally out of my control, but it's not out of your control, and tuck it under his agenda? All these things that make you anxious and angry and wish you were dead. Are you going to put second things second? Because these are all second things. C.S. Lewis said, when we put first things first, in this case, God as God, we get second things thrown in. When we put second things first, we lose both. Pay attention to your anxieties. Pay attention to your angers. Pay attention to your secret suicidal thoughts when things go bad. And notice who is standing in the place of God. And change your mind about it. Be humbled. Be drawn to God. Well, there you go, a little light teaching. I'm sure you'll forget all about it. Now, I think this is important. I think it's super important. I think this idea is ripe in the Bible. And I think in a post-holiday funk, it's a good time to stop and consider what really matters. All right.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.